Hello, everybody, and welcome back to a new Science Studio program. Today we're going to be talking to a gentleman who started out as a scientist, is still a scientist, but at some stage in his career decided that working for the National Science Foundation, which is the granddaddy that looks after science research, especially the non-biomedical type of research, in the United States. And his name is Carlos Morillo. And Carlos, welcome to Science Studio.
Well, it is a pleasure to be here, Keith. I mean, it's very nice to see you again after
many years. Right. And we still look as good as we did 16, 17 years ago. So something's going right. How did you get into science? This program, we like to sort of introduce the listener to the scientist. And what were those sort of definitive actions or non-actions earlier in life that made you think, hey, science is good. I can do this and I want to do it.
There are people who go to a path that have a very, very well-defined path right from the beginning. This was not my case. I grew up in a very poor family, and, speaking of science was not the major thing at the dinner table. You know, others were more important. However, I went to grade school, and I had a very good science teacher. So I was introduced to science very early at school.
Do you remember some of those first illustrations of science that your teacher showed you?
Oh, yeah, sure. It was mostly at the time, in biology. So the structures of the cells and the...
In grade school?
In grade school, yeah. And then, I went to high school.
Did you dissect frogs and things like that?
Oh, sure.
You did, and you liked this.
Yeah. It was fun, listen, there were all kinds of crickets and all kinds of frogs.
You come from Puerto Rico, right?
I come from Costa Rica.
Oh, Costa Rica.
Yeah, so right there in the rainforest,
Lots of things to cut up.
Lots of things to chop up.
All right.
Yeah, so then I went on to high school. I have an excellent chemistry teacher. And that's where my interest, move a little bit from the biology to chemistry, which, I am a chemist. Move on to the university. At the beginning, my intention was to be a doctor, the idea of doing some good for other people, becoming a medical doctor. That was appealing, Costa Rica, you don't have to pay for college, so which is a big advantage.
But a smaller number of people go to college.
Yes, so I did that, and again, I found excellent, very, very good chemistry teachers. And they took me under their own wing, and so they convinced me that... microbiology, medicine is important, but we need chemists, people who can increase production in the country and so on and so forth.
And maybe the concept that chemistry can also help people.
Exactly. So that we went into that, and then one of the advantages that I had is that they actually allowed me to borrow their books. And that was a major difference because for somebody who barely eat, having books cost a lot of money. That was a big incentive.
That's interesting.
And so...
And the implication there was not a large library that you had access to.
Exactly. And so then I took on into chemistry and... Obviously, I liked it. I loved to be in the lab,
right?
And making new things that nobody have ever made before,
right? Whether they're useful or not, that's not the important thing.
At that point in time, that was not the important thing. So just doing science for the science.
We'll come back to that a little later in the program because that is one of the big issues of the moment. Uh-huh. Science for the sake of science or science for the sake of society, if you like. Uh-huh. And clearly the two aren't completely orthogonal, but there is a tension there.
I don't think this is the case. I mean, immediately you say, this can be true. You need to do something that is productive. But the thing is, it takes years for science to get into something that is of importance to society. And there are many, 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 many examples. We can go into some of them later on.
So you're a chemist, or you trained as a chemist.
I'm
now you're an administrator, scientist, which is even more complicated. But tell us, what branch of chemistry really fascinated you?
My interest was in inorganic chemistry, the study of compounds with different metal atoms and different type of interactions, and how these interactions can help in producing stuff. Let's just call it stuff.
That, ladies and gentlemen, is the articulate chemist for you.
Yeah, sure.
We like to make stuff.
Exactly.
And sometimes the stuff is very beautiful, sometimes it's not, but, you know, it's the idea of making new materials and investigating their properties.
Well, you know, as an example, for example, you know, a lot of these compounds end up being catalysts, being something that accelerate processes, and we wouldn't be having the type of life that we have nowadays without them.
Absolutely. So just again,
petrochemicals, the catalytic converter in the automobile.
Yeah. And so I think the audience will remember that platinum is a big element as that, which just wants me to distinguish that when you say metals, you're really talking about what we tend to think of as the transition metals.
Yes.
As opposed to the main group metals like lead or tin, things of that nature. So you went to school at Texas A&M, is that right?
Yeah, I did my undergraduate in Costa Rica, and then right. And then I went to Texas A&M as a graduate student. So I did my PhD, worked with a very well-known chemist, and I finished very quickly. I finished in about 3 years. I finished in 3 years.
Okay.
And then I went on to Princeton as a postdoc. And from then, went back to Costa Rica. I felt very important that it was, I need to do something for the country. And I went on, and I started right at the bottom, became a full professor rather quickly, and worked there for many years. And then after that, I was asked by Texas A&M to go back, and then that's when I came to the United States, and ever since I've been in the U.S.
Let's talk about that as a sort of a principle of science, that a lot of people come to the United States and also to Britain and Germany from what we'll call the developing world, for want of a better term. And there's always a sort of a tension right there between bringing people from the developing world and bring them into a very sophisticated research environment in the sort of first world, if you like. And then what happens? You know, they're not, mostly a lot of them stay. And so, you know, you made a very clear choice to go back and then later on came back. So you could give back, as you say, to your own country. I've often thought that there should be some form of ruling involved where, in fact, all students that come to the United States or the United Kingdom must go back, at least for a certain period of time, in order to sort of develop the science, develop the theories, the activity, the equipment, all the rest of it, back in their home country.
On that, you know, I don't know that there has to be a rule, but, I mean, this is one of those principles that, you know, should guide just about everybody. I mean, you need to give back to the hand that help you at the beginning.
Right.
You know, when I went back to Costa Rica, one of the things I did was to start developing a good chemistry laboratory for research. I trained a lot of students. Many of those students were sent to Germany, France, the U.S., and other places and got their PhDs. And I feel very good now when I go back to Costa Rica to the chemistry department, and all of those former students are now the professors, and now their students are doing the same thing. So,
has that developed into good graduate programs back in Costa Rica?
Absolutely. So this is one of the things in which, you know, I wouldn't feel good if, you know, by coming here, if I didn't have put the seeds
and back into
in the home country to do the things. Now, I'm here. I'm a U.S. citizen. And I feel very strongly that, okay, again, this is a country that gave me the basics when I did the PhD. I did it here. And it is important. You know, science is not limited to certain area. I mean, science is pretty universal. So your advances that are being done here are being used elsewhere.
I mean, have you noticed in your position at NSF, and we'll come to that in a moment, but mm-hmm. you obviously have to travel quite a bit, and I'm sure you go back to Costa Rica and maybe other Central American countries. Do you see over the last 20 years a real flourishing of doing intensive scientific research Costa Rica and related?
There is no question. The number of research papers that is being produced, not only the number, but the quality of the journals that are being published, there is a very, very definite increase. Now, perhaps in many ways, Costa Rica is unique, at least in Central America, because of the political stability that we have had for many years, and that has helped also in many other areas. But the biological diversity that the country has, the country gets a lot of visitors, scientists, and there are collaborations with those scientists from outside, and it's like adding a little bit of fertilizer to your soil, and things began to grow.
I mean, most people outside of Costa Rica who have never been there know two things, I think, about Costa Rica. It has little or no military, and it has a lot of what we call ecotourism mm-hmm. because of this incredible diversity. So as you said, I think Costa Rica is particularly fortunate. So going back to then the science that's flourishing there, the seed that's grown, is that really aimed towards the environmental biodiversity, or does it still involve other areas?
There are other areas. I mean, some of my former students are doing material science. So, they're producing new materials. They're finding new uses for things. Others are doing, the more classic inorganic chemistry,
Give me an idea, or give the listener an idea about the materials science part, because that's a very sophisticated interdisciplinary activity
absolutely.
Needs lots of equipment, lots of teamwork. Uh-huh. How does that work in Costa Rica?
You have the key word in this, is teamwork. You can no longer be a good scientist just by yourself, with very few exceptions, of course. But to do material science, you need to have a team that understands chemistry. You need a team that understands engineering, so how to transfer those new materials into something that you can manufacture, you can make, for, let's say, a solar panel. There is a lot of chemistry there, but the components by themselves won't work. You have to put them in certain ways, and in that way you need an engineer.
So, in fact, then, the seeds that were sown to get science back into Costa Rica in a big scale, as engineering, physics, chemistry, it's all there?
It's all there.
That's wonderful.
It's all there.
You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm here with Dr. Carlos Morillo from the National Science Foundation. We'll be back in one brief moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. David Niesel.
And I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog. Hey, Dave, pass me the nano sponges. I've got to clean up toxins in my blood.
They're not really tiny sponges, are they?
No, but they act like sponges by trapping toxins that damage healthy cells. Nano sponges are 90 times smaller than our red blood cell, but they can absorb between 30 and 900 cell-damaging toxin molecules. Imagine these nanosponges flooding your body when you're infected by bacteria such as Streptococcus and Staphylococcus, families of bacteria that includes MRSA, which is deadly.
These two pathogens can be resistant to many antibiotics, and they produce pore-forming toxins. These toxins insert themselves in the cell membrane, creating holes that end up killing the cells, including red blood cells.
But in a study with mice, remarkably, 90% of mice treated with the nanosponges before MRSA infection survived. Even if the nanosponges were given after a MRSA infection, 44% of the mice still survived.
The nanosponges are made out of a polymer, the same biodegradable material used in some implants. Then they're covered with pieces of red blood cell membrane to cloak them from the immune system. Otherwise, they'd be immediately removed by white blood cells.
Toxins that come into contact with pieces of red blood cell membrane attach to the nanosponges, form pores, and are trapped by the core polymer. Eventually, they're eliminated by the liver. The strength of this therapy is that it works on a number of toxins compared with other treatments which target only one specific toxin.
This technology is promising because it has the potential to be used in other treatments, even in delivering cancer-killing drugs.
We are Drs. David Niesel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more on this and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Carlos Murillo, and we were talking just now before we went away for a break about the development of science and technology in a developing country. Let's just jump to a little bit now about the funding, because this is, I know a lot of people who listen to this program say, Keith, you got this fixation about funding. Well, I do, because without the funding, we cannot get too much new science. So very briefly, how does funding work in Costa Rica and how does it work in the United States? You're in a position to talk about this.
Well, you know, Costa Rica, there is a major entity. It's called CONICET. It's very similar. Most of Latin America will have an entity that have similar name, which is normally refers to the Consejo Nacional de Ciencia y Tecnología. So a lot of the money that goes into research goes through this consejo. People submit proposals. The proposals are evaluated. And then based on the merits, the money is allocated. It's a similar system in the United States. Let's say, for example, in the National Science Foundation. And here I have to make a disclaimer, you know, I need to say that, you know, when I talk about the National Science Foundation, I'm talking, you know, the opinions are mine. These are not the official.
It's not policy.
It's not policy. So it's absolutely not the policy of the National Science Foundation there. So you do the same thing. We receive proposals from various persons or entities in the U.S., and proposals are evaluated, and then the money is allocated based on the merit of the proposal.
Yeah, of course, the merit of the proposal has to be somebody who is making those decisions. And so this concept of peer review, when we send it out, and I think to a range of different people who have got expertise in the area or tangentially, and then you sort of come to some final arrangement. There's been criticism of the peer review system. Now, I understand the criticism because it can lead to a certain amount of conservatism, people coming out with randomly great new ideas, and then they're too advanced for a lot of the evaluators. How do you cope with that in the NSF?
Oh, we have a lot of programs that try to deal with that, and there are a lot of mechanisms that try to deal with this particular situation. The vast majority of the proposals are evaluated by the mechanism that you mentioned. You know, the proposals are sent out to experts, and the experts make their comments. As program officers, we read them, and we decide, okay, you know, is this valid criticism or isn't it? Or sometimes you need to go to another person to resolve some of the issues. But, you know, there are cases in which, you know, the ideas are really advanced. You know, there are no preliminary data, but there is a really, really great, you know, somebody thinks they have a really great idea. There are mechanisms in which directly the program officers can make the decision. So we can make an award normally for a lot less than most of our awards are for 3 years. So we make an award for, let's say, 1 year and say, okay, well, here you have funding for 1 year. Show that this idea is find some preliminary data and then come back next year with a regular proposal that you can convince the rest of the world. I have preliminary data and see my idea is working and there is potential here. And so, you know.
So would that apply across the board? Let's say you get one from biology, geology, from all over.
Yeah.
Does that group of proposals go to one particular panel?
No. They are not reviewed by panels. They are not reviewed by outsiders. They're all internally reviewed.
Okay. So there's a special program for that.
Yes. Well, I mean, the proposal goes to the person in charge of any given program. And, you know, we might, as a program director of one particular program, if I receive one, I may go to my colleagues and ask my colleagues, okay, give me your impression of this. So we discuss it internally and make the decision internally. So we don't go to outside experts. But those are the very, you know, only few proposals that we do that way.
Let's talk about the role of science in society. I mean, I'm a scientist. I think I've got two patents in my whole career, which I think, you know, I'm not driven that way, but others are, and rightfully so. But the tension, if you see any, between science for the sake of science and then science for a particular issue that society feels it needs to answer, how do you balance that?
Well, you know, at least in my case, you know, I work for the National Science Foundation. What is the mission of the foundation? If you look at the mission statement, it's to promote the science to advance national health, prosperity, welfare, and defense.
So it actually says in the National Science Foundation,
that is the mission
promotion
statement.
Of health?
Yes.
That's interesting because, I mean, one tends to think of the National Institutes of
Health. Advanced National Health.
I didn't know that was in the NSF.
That is part of the mission statement. Oh. Now, specific, you know, the National Institute of Health does a lot of the, you know, disease. You know, so there is a specific disease, people go to the National Institute of Health. But a lot of the basic research that actually helps understand the basics, the very basics of diseases in general, begin at NSF, in the Biological Directorate. Chemistry, for example, have a program, specific program, that is chemistry of life processes. So we have a specific program that try to understand the science of what happens in the biological systems.
I guess what I was trying to get at, because I remember before the Second World War, I know the British government got a very specialized team of scientists to sort of look ahead. What are the big things that need to happen to push science and therefore society, and obviously they were talking about British society at that time, forward. And I think the most dramatic thing they came up with was synthetic rubber, okay, because they could foresee the travel lines between Malaysia, where they were getting natural rubber, and the UK were going to be compromised in any future warfare. I mean, that seems a very narrow, and it missed, of course, all the wonderful things that were going to come later in science. Mm-hmm. And so your feeling about concentrating too much about the immediate needs.
Well, this is one thing that science cannot do. For example, you know, again, the National Science Foundation, if I go back to it, what do? We support basic research. But there is one more thing that we support. It's basic research and education.
Yeah.
One of our major goals is to create the future scientists.
Absolutely.
And a lot of the support that goes out to science goes to students to do the science. And in doing that science, they get trained on the thinking of what goes behind it.
I remember maybe 20 years ago when I started getting proposals from NSF. And since I was at that time here at UT El Paso, where undergraduate research is very important, or was very important, it still is, but now there's all these plethora of graduate programs too. And I was always amazed when I'd see proposals coming in from very well-respected research groups that would never think to put into their proposal or their funding support for undergraduate research. And I always kept sending back to whoever the program directors were the critique that, hey, why do they need another four postdocs from mostly around the world, I would say, and I don't see any evidence that they're trying to produce from their own institution undergraduates to be the next generation. I think that's changed a lot.
Oh, it has. There are many programs now that encourage the...
But is it part of every research program that should be part of what is happening?
The vast majority of the research programs that we support have student support.
Well, undergraduate students as well as graduates, or just graduates?
Both. and there are also postdocs. The emphasis varies. Some institutions have put more emphasis in certain groups. Other institutions put more emphasis, but there is, you know, there is a balance.
I guess I'm trying to get to the point: should there be a balance? Should it be so clear that you can send in a proposal which assiduously avoids using undergraduates, since most of these proposals go to universities?
Different universities manage, I think, this in a different way. A lot of the universities, in case of the undergraduates do the research as part of a course, so they don't get paid directly. It's mostly for graduate students that there is a stipend.
Right.
And a lot of the universities also require that some of the graduate students teach. So a lot of the graduate students actually are paid by the institutions that are as teaching assistants. What we look at is that there is a large number of students that are being educated as to whether there is money allocated to a specific group or not. We leave it up to the individual investigators to decide what works best for them.
Okay. We're recording this in El Paso, Texas, in the studios of KTEP. You're down here to do a little bit of research. You're taking a sort of a hiatus from your role up at the National Science Foundation. In a nutshell, what are you looking for here?
Anyway, I should preface this by saying that one of the former students of mine is now a professor at UT El Paso. So we have continued some of the collaboration, and there is some research that we have been carrying out jointly. And we spent a good part of the day yesterday working on writing of a manuscript.
What's the work? Tell us the work. The work
deals with magnetic compounds. Magnetism is very important nowadays. You know, you use magnetic not only to stick things in your refrigerator, you know, the magnet to put yourself a reminder in the refrigerator, but, you know, this is what controls a lot of the computing systems. This is what controls nowadays. You have a problem with yourself, medical problem. You go to the...
You get an MRI.
You get an MRI,
right.
Magnetic resonance imaging.
Yeah.
So you get an image with magnetic things. So what one of the things we're doing is we're carrying out some experiments with quite a sophisticated instrument. It's an electron paramagnetic resonance. So it's more in the basic area, but this is one of the things that in the long run it's going to provide information as to how to control magnetic materials in a very, very precise manner.
Do you see this going towards magnetic resonance imaging, for example, or
not? This will be more in the computing, in the new computing systems.
Okay, lovely. Well, Carlos Burillo, it's been fun seeing you again after 14, 15 years. You're looking well, and obviously your career has now taken a slightly different path, but you're still maintaining a contact with basic research. You're helping allocate funds, and this is great. So thank you very much for being here on Science Studio.
Well, it's always a pleasure to come to El Paso, you know, a very different scenery from there.
From D.C.
From D.C.
Sure. Right. And we'd like to thank Norma Martinez, for being there, as usual, with her smile and her technology and her talent. We'll be back next week. Bye-bye.
I'm Noemi Rojas with your Synapse Flash. El Paso businessman Jack Cardwell has given a major donation to the Medical Center of the Americas Foundation. It will support the development of the region's first ever biomedical research park. The park's first building will break ground next year, and it will be called the Cardwell Collaborative. Read more at mcasynapse.org.